I ran out of time, or I mean, I stopped last time because we were out of time. But I just wanted you to realize that I actually had finished the chapter, even though there's a slide left. I already talked about 30, but slide 31, some of these slideshows have a slide like this at the end. It's just a summary slide, and I don't read those to you because it's all stuff I've already covered, but I leave them in there because they can be good to study with. But we're done with that. Let's go on to this next chapter, which is a tour of the cell. So we're going to talk about the various structures that make up a cell, most of which are organelles, and most of those are membrane-bounded organelles, more specifically. So we're mostly going to be talking about eukaryotic cells, of course, but we'll talk about both. We can see cells right here in the middle of this enormously big scale, enormously big range of sizes, I should say. This is a logarithmic scale. So each step is 10 times bigger than the one below it. It goes from the size of atoms all the way up to 10 meters, which is still not as big as the biggest organisms. I mean, tall trees are even bigger than that. But that is a huge, that's, what is it, 13 orders of magnitude or something right here? Each of these is an order of magnitude, 10 times bigger. So it's huge range that we are interested, huge range of sizes that we are still interested in just within the science of biology. But this chapter focuses on cells, and they're right here in the middle of this listed range that, notice, are below the limits of the unaided eye. So there's some range in cell sizes, but most cells are just a little bit too small to see with the human eye, which is why we use light microscopes to see them. We can see even finer detail with electron microscopes, you know, down to the level of large atoms. But I guess the major point here is that although there is some range in sizes of cells, it's not a big range, and I'll explain why in a minute. In other words, most cells are pretty similar in size despite the huge variety and size of organisms. Compared to most organisms that have ever lived, we are huge. Plenty of things bigger than we are, but we're enormous organisms compared to most organisms. We still don't, that doesn't mean we have big cells, though. We're just made out of a lot of equally small cells. Well, I'll get back to that in a minute, but first let's go to look at two. This is not a eukaryotic cell. You can tell that because it doesn't have a nucleus. Well, remember, a prokaryotic cell not only doesn't have a nucleus, which is just one example of a membrane-bounded organelle, a prokaryotic cell doesn't have any membrane-bounded organelles, which means it has just one membrane, the membrane that defines every cell. Every cell has a plasma membrane. And a prokaryotic cell has that membrane, and that's it. And this is why, for a prokaryotic cell, there is only one compartment in the cell, since it has that one membrane. And we call all of the stuff contained within that plasma membrane collectively the cytosol. I mean, the cytoplasm. Cytosol is the liquid component of the cytoplasm. Even though a prokaryotic cell doesn't have a nucleus, by definition of being a prokaryote, it, of course, still has DNA. DNA is where you find, I mean, the nucleus is where you find DNA in a eukaryotic organism, but of course, prokaryotic cells have to have DNA for the exact same reasons that any living cell does. It's not in its own compartment, though, because there is no compartmentalization in a prokaryotic cell. The DNA is more or less found in a region of the cytoplasm, not actually technically a different chamber, and that region is called the nucleoid, which means like a nucleus. It's not true nucleus because it doesn't have its own membrane. The shapes of prokaryotic cells can vary pretty drastically. They don't all look like this rod-shaped one. This is kind of just a catch-all picture. And they don't all necessarily have all of these features. For instance, not all prokaryotic cells have flagella, which are these whip-like appendages. Some do, though, which are they help in locomotion, moving the cell from point A to point B. This one also happens to have these hair-like fimbriae, which is the plural of fimbria. Those can also help in locomotion, but they can help in anchoring it to some substrate as well, like the back of your throat, for instance. These little brown dots are organelles. They're ribosomes, which we'll talk much more about, not only today, but eventually more detail later. That doesn't violate what a prokaryote is, though. Prokaryotes don't have membrane-bounded organelles, and ribosomes are not membrane-bounded organelles. They're tiny, tiny. They're really molecular machines, and they are there for the purpose of assembling polypeptides. Any cell, whether it's prokaryotic or eukaryotic, requires proteins for all the things that proteins do, and that's why it has to have DNA and ribosomes. DNA to stand as the original code, ribosomes to actually assemble the polypeptides. Oh, I didn't mention the cell wall. Typically, a prokaryotic cell will have a cell wall. Now, every cell has a plasma membrane, but only certain kinds of cells have a cell wall exterior to that plasma membrane. And if it is a cell with a cell wall, like a typical prokaryotic cell, the cell wall is much thicker and much sturdier a device than the plasma membrane. It's a little bit analogous to the structural wall of this room is really what gives the wall its strength. The paint on the interior surface is like the plasma membrane just inside that cell wall. Our cells, animal cells in general, do not have cell walls. They have a plasma membrane, which is relatively flimsy compared to a cell wall. But in cells that have a cell wall, that sturdiness can hold in pressure, keeping the cells from exploding under certain conditions. Three, this is another generalized slide, so it applies to any cell, not just prokaryotic or eukaryotic. We're seeing a little section of plasma membrane here. And plasma membrane, as I've mentioned before, is chiefly composed of phospholipids, arranged into a phospholipid bilayer like we talked about. But that's not all a plasma membrane is made out of. It can't be, a living cell's plasma membrane can't be purely phospholipids, because if it is, then certain things that can't get through directly through the phospholipid bilayer will not be able to get into or out of the cell, and some of those things are required for life. That's why a functioning plasma membrane in a living cell needs to be a phospholipid bilayer with a bunch of other things in that substructure, allowing certain things in and out, among other functions. That's not the only things that these proteins that you see here in purple, as purple globs, perform. Some proteins allow things in and out. There's other kinds of functions that membrane-bound proteins have. These are membrane-bound, right? Not membrane-bounded proteins. These are tied to and therefore part of the membrane. Membrane-bound proteins we'll talk about later as well. But remember why the phospholipid bilayer forms to begin with. It does that automatically simply because each individual phospholipid is trying to have its tails avoid water. So when they arrange themselves in a tail-to-tail bilayer, then only the heads are exposed to water, which they don't care about at all because the heads are polar just like water is. Okay, now to four. And we can continue talking about why cells do not have very big range in sizes. You know, you all started as one cell, the zygote, your zygote that you started as. And you're much bigger now, but you're not just a huge zygote, a huge human body-sized zygote, right? And that would be impossible. Large organisms get large not because their cell becomes huge, but because they produce a bunch of cells. Large organisms are multicellular. They're not just made of a huge cell. And huge cells are impossible if the cell is going to remain alive. This is what the slide is trying to indicate. Using little cubes to indicate cells. Most cells are not perfect cubes. Well, none is a perfect cube, but some of them are kind of cubic. Anyway, we're using cubes here just because it's easier to think about the math, but it would apply to any volume. There is a constraint or a limit put on how big a cell can get, or at least how big a cell can grow in all three dimensions. Now, a cell can get long as it's still small in the other two dimensions, like a neuron, for instance. There's one neuron that runs from my foot to the base of my spinal cord. That's one cell. That's enormously long, but tiny in the other two dimensions. What I'm saying here is that a cell can't get big in all three dimensions at once. It can't get long, deep, and tall all at once. And here's why. The constraint, the limit, is what we call the surface area to volume ratio. Like any ratio, that's just one number divided by another number, right? It's just a fraction. And in this case, you divide the surface area by the volume for that object. And here we represent a single-celled organism by this one cube. Notice there aren't any dimensions given here. It's just one, just the magnitude. And that's because the dimension doesn't matter. You could use any one you want. But the point is, this single-celled organism, small organism, is one by one by one. Right? Now, how do you compute the surface area? Well, it's a cube, so it has six identical faces, right? Each face is one by one. So the area would be one times one, right? For one face. But there are six of them. So it's one by one, one square unit of area times six, because there are six faces. So the overall area is six square units. Does that make sense? The volume, on the other hand, is one times one times one cubic unit, right? Because it's one by one by one. So that's why this one is here for the total volume. Therefore, the surface area to volume ratio is 6 divided by 1, which is 6. That's pretty straightforward, hopefully. Now we're going to grow the cell, though. This one cell is now 5 times bigger in all three dimensions. 5 times wider, 5 times deeper, 5 times taller. So we do the computations the same way. Each face is now 5 by 5 square units. Right, 25 square units per face times 5 is 150 square units of surface area. The volume is now 5 times 5 times 5 cubic units, or 125 cubic units. And therefore, now the surface area to volume ratio, 150 divided by 125, is 1.2. So by growing, by getting bigger, a cell reduces its surface area to volume ratio. Surface area to volume ratio gets smaller. Notice that both of the components of the ratio get bigger as it grows, as you would expect. Surface area went up, volume went up. But the point is that surface area is a square function. Right? If you map y equals x squared for the positive numbers, which would be the surface area, it goes up, gets bigger and bigger, right? But if you map y equals x cubed, which would be the volume, it gets big a lot faster than area does, or than y equals x squared does. So the point here is that if a cell gets big in all three dimensions, both the volume and the surface area are going to go up, but volume is going to get bigger much quicker than surface area does. Volume outgrows surface area. And that's why it's a limit to how big cells can get. Because the bigger a cell gets, the more volume it has, the more stuff it has inside it that needs to be serviced. And by serviced, I mean that a living cell has to continuously exchange materials with the environment. Things have to be brought in, things have to be gotten rid of. And where does that happen? At the edge, namely the surface, right? That's where the exchange has to take place. So if the volume gets too big for the surface is not enough to handle that amount of transfer of things into and out of the cell. Well, that's why to get big, an organism doesn't just grow a one cell. Instead, it makes itself out of a bunch of little cells that are just as big as a unicellular organism. Only as small, I mean. So this multicellular organism being represented on the right, is exactly the same volume as this fictional 5x5x5 cell, has the same total volume, but each individual cell is now 1x1x1, and therefore each individual cell has a surface area to volume ratio of 6, which is big enough to allow it to continue to live. Now on to 5, and this slide takes a while to get through. You might have noticed that there's a lot of slides in this show, but we can go through them a lot quicker after we get through this slide. And that's because I want to go through these parts individually. Then we can speed up as we go to separate slides that show you close-ups of each component. This is an animal cell, first of all. In slide 6, we'll see a similar picture for a plant cell. Since it's an animal cell, obviously you should realize that that's a eukaryotic cell, right? All animals are eukaryotes. And you can tell, even if you didn't know it's an animal cell, you can tell it's a eukaryotic cell because it has a nucleus. Now, the color coding, of course, is just the publisher's choice. The real cell would be pretty transparent. But the nucleus is in violet in this picture. And the nucleus is not only an example of a membrane-bounded organelle, which only eukaryotic cells have, but more specifically, it is the first of three examples I'll give you of what are multiply membrane-bounded organelles, meaning organelles enclosed by two or more layers of membrane. The nucleus has two layers of membrane. And I'm not talking about the bilayer when I say two. A single layer of membrane is two layers of phospholipid, right? One phospholipid bilayer, which is two monolayers, makes up one membrane. I'm talking about two layers of membrane, so two layers of phospholipid bilayers. And so there's an outer membrane and an inner membrane. That's what they're actually called, and that's pretty self-descriptive. And you might be able to see it right here in the cutaway view, depending on how far away you are, but there's two layers of membrane here. And notice that, well, first of all, those two layers collectively are called the nuclear envelope, the covering of the nucleus. They define the nucleus, of course, the boundary of the nucleus. Also, I want you to remember what I've said before when we were originally talking about eukaryotic and prokaryotic cells, namely that because eukaryotic cells have membrane-bounded organelles, they are compartmentalized, whereas prokaryotic cells are not. They just have one chamber, the cytoplasm. There is still a cytoplasm in a eukaryotic cell, but it's just the stuff that is inside the cell, but outside of all the membrane-bounded organelles in that cell. And so the stuff inside the nucleus does not qualify as cytoplasm, right? It's inside a membrane-bounded organelle. We call the stuff that's contained in the nucleus the nucleoplasm. And mostly, that stuff in the nucleoplasm is chromatin. Chromatin is a mixture of two kinds of molecules, two of the macromolecules that we talked about. Chromatin is DNA plus a bunch of proteins complexed together with it to keep it well arranged. And we'll revisit chromatin a lot more later on because we spend the whole second half of the term on DNA. But that's what chromatin refers to. It's the stuff that chromosomes are made out of. Don't be confused by the word, or be careful with the word nucleolus, because it's a different spelling from nucleus, and it's a different thing. The nucleolus is just a component of the nucleus. This kind of darker region right here is the nucleolus, which has the function of producing various kinds of RNA other than messenger RNA. I just briefly talked about messenger RNA already, right? That's what's produced in the step of gene expression called transcription, which is what DNA is directly involved in, right? The kind of RNA that's made when a gene gets transcribed is messenger RNA. But there's all kinds of different other different RNA types, and those are made at the nucleolus of the nucleus in a eukaryotic cell. Not just animals. That's true for all. If you look at the nuclear envelope on here, you can see a bunch of these little magenta circles. Those are complexes of proteins arranged with a hollow center functioning as little tunnels. They are nuclear pores. And that's important because, speaking of this messenger RNA that gets produced as part of gene expression, the reason you produce messenger RNA is so that you can then take that information that's in DNA and has to stay in the nucleus out of the nucleus, go meet up with a ribosome to actually assemble the polypeptide. Therefore, the messenger RNA has to be able to leave the nucleus, and it does so through these nuclear pores. Also on the outer membrane of the nucleus, of the nuclear envelope, here and there, not just this one place, but you can see it here on this slide, the outer membrane of the nucleus folds outward, and notice it changes from purple to blue here because they're using blue coating for this next organelle. The point, though, is that it's the same membrane, the external membrane of the nucleus starts to fold outward every so often and becomes the membrane making up this second organelle in blue, which is the endoplasmic reticulum. They are continuous in terms of membrane material, but they're distinct when you think of them as organelles. Nucleus is distinct from endoplasmic reticulum. And the endoplasmic reticulum, as you see, is pretty extensive. It takes up a lot of room in the animal cell. It also, as you see here, consists of two major parts. ER is just short for endoplasmic reticulum, but there is the so-called rough ER, all of this stuff, and the so-called smooth ER. The roughness of appearance of the so-called rough endoplasmic reticulum comes from the fact that the membrane making up the rough endoplasmic reticulum is studded by a bunch of brown ribosomes. Now, the ribosomes are actually not part of the endoplasmic reticulum. They're just temporarily associated with the membrane of the endoplasmic reticulum, but there's always some there. It's not always the same ones. They'll change throughout time. But that's what makes it, to a microscopist looking at these things under a microscope, look rough. That's why it was named rough endoplasmic reticulum. The smooth endoplasmic reticulum is not only smooth because it doesn't have these ribosomes associated with it, but notice it's more tubular in shape rather than flattened pancakes. But the two combined, rough and smooth ER, make up one overall organelle. It's an elaborate membrane folding back and forth. The major job of the rough endoplasmic reticulum, it doesn't just look different from the smooth, it doesn't just look different from the rough, but it has a different job. The major job of the smooth endoplasmic reticulum is production of lipids. The rough endoplasmic reticulum, on the other hand, has the job of modifying newly made polypeptides. So when a polypeptide is created, one amino acid at a time, at a ribosome, You know, that polypeptide is going to be whatever polypeptide it is. Sometimes a polypeptide right off of the assembly line doesn't need any modification. It can just fold up into three-dimensional shape and start working for whatever it is. Other kinds of polypeptides, though, do need to be modified. Making them is not enough. You have to make them first, and then you have to modify them, which is after they're created. And that's the job of the rough ER, which explains why all these ribosomes are here. Ribosomes are the little molecular machines assembling the polypeptides, one amino acid at a time. And if they're associated with the membrane of the rough ER, then that means this new, brand new polypeptide coming off gradually off the assembly line, getting longer and longer, is going to be strung into the hollow interior, which is a word for hollow interior, is the lumen of the rough endoplasmic reticulum, allowing that rough endoplasmic reticulum to accept that brand new polypeptide and do some sort of modification to it. Some other kind of molecule might be hooked to it. Some amino acids might be cleaved off of it. There's all kinds of modifications, but those modifications are performed by the rough ER. When that modification is done, the rough endoplasmic reticulum will package that newly modified polypeptide into a little sac-like structure made out of a piece of membrane that is part of, at the moment, the rough ER. A little piece of membrane will bubble off of the rough ER, encapsulating the newly modified protein. And this is the first example of several that in which pieces of membrane get moved around from organelle to organelle. They eventually end up in the plasma membrane, then they get taken back up. They move all through all kinds of different organelles that are made of membrane. And that's another important point. Membrane material is not different from one organelle to another. Not drastically different. It's all made out of phospholipid bilayer. So therefore, it's easy for it to get moved around. And when a piece of membrane touches another piece of membrane, it will kind of fuse into it easily because it's all phospholipids. Okay, the very next door organelle that you would probably, if it weren't colorized here, confuse for just more endoplasmic reticulum, this teal stuff, is its own organelle. That is the Golgi apparatus, as this book calls it. Some books call it the Golgi complex. Either way, it's named after a dead Italian. But its job is totally different. It doesn't modify newly made proteins. That's the job of the rough ER. Once that modification is done, then that little package that I was talking about, which is called a vesicle, containing the newly made polypeptide, gets sent to the Golgi apparatus for routing. The Golgi apparatus, in other words, serves more or less as a receiving and shipping center. If you want to favor them over USPS or UPS or DHL. Shipping and receiving center, a receiving and shipping center because it receives first. So it receives the vesicle from the Golgi complex, receives the vesicle, the little package from the rough endoplasmic reticulum, figures out where that particular parcel needs to go, that protein needs to go, and then sends it in the correct direction. Sometimes the protein needs to go to the plasma membrane to become part of the plasma membrane. That can be done. Sometimes the protein needs to be totally exported outside of the cell. You know, you have proteins between cells in a lot of organisms, in multicellular organisms, I mean. But no protein is created outside of a cell. It takes a cell to create a protein at ribosomes. But if they're intended to work outside of the cell, they're made inside the cell and then exported. And so the Golgi complex figures that out. And It will receive the vesicle, which is a little piece of membrane that fuses into the Golgi and becomes part of the Golgi membrane. And then on the way out, at the other side, it will create a new vesicle out of Golgi membrane and send that to the plasma membrane, for instance, which will then fuse into the plasma membrane. So membrane material is always being moved around and recycled. Okay, ribosomes I've talked about, and we'll talk more about them as well. Lysosomes is next, as we work our way around clockwise, I guess. The some part of lysosome means body. Somatic, for instance, means of the body. What does lyso mean? Or what word is it similar to?
Lysol.
Well, yeah, Lysol. Which is why it got that name. What about hydrolysis? That has that same L-Y-S in it, right? It means splitting. So Lysol explodes cells, basically, to kill the germs. But a lysosome is a splitting body. Literally what it means. But it is just like a vesicle, as I just described a vesicle, meaning it's a little bag made out of membrane. But it has its own name, and it's its own organelle because it has a specific function, which is to degrade or break apart or digest. Now, when I say digest here, I'm not talking about food, right? Food is digested outside of your body, like I've already talked about, and then molecules are absorbed into your body. So we're talking about digesting molecules, breaking them apart, basically, is the better phrase. But doing that, breaking apart molecules into smaller chunks, which is lysis, hydrolysis, that requires enzymes, hydrolytic enzymes. In other words, enzymes specialized for hydrolysis. And hydrolytic enzymes are dangerous things to have around because they can split apart things that you don't want to split apart. That's why those potentially dangerous hydrolytic enzymes are kept in their own little bag of membrane called a lysosome. And the stuff you want to split gets put into that lysosome so it can be hydrolyzed safely away from the other contents of the cell. Mitochondrion is next. A couple orange bean-shaped mitochondria, which is the plural of mitochondrion. But this is pointing to a single mitochondrion. And this is the second example of a multiply membrane-bounded organelle. Just like the nucleus, the mitochondrion has two membranes, an outer membrane and an inner membrane, which you can more easily see from even from where you are. The outer membrane is just a smooth membrane that's big enough to contain the whole thing. The inner membrane is actually bigger than the outer membrane because it folds back and forth many times. Now, why would you have folding of the membrane inside? Why would you fold a membrane back and forth? What does that accomplish?
To keep a cycle going?
I don't think I know what you mean. But that's not why a mitochondrion does it. Do you want to say what you mean? Okay, you don't have to. I just don't really understand what you're saying. The folding back and forth increases the surface area. The more membrane you have, the more surface area of membrane you have, right? And you find that in places where you have to have a lot of proteins embedded in membrane to do a certain job. So mitochondria are the inner membrane is folded back and forth because the major job of the mitochondria is a complex set of reactions we'll study later called cellular respiration. For now, I'll just say that cellular respiration in cells that are capable of doing it is a way to drastically increase how much energy useful energy in the form of ATP can be extracted from molecules that started out as food. So it's highly, much more efficient than processing food for energy using a different mechanism. That happens, though, in eukaryotes, that happens in mitochondria. And for that to happen, and we'll look at the details after you take this next test. Unit 3 is when we'll study all this. Making that cellular respiration happen, though, requires a lot of proteins embedded in membrane. Well, the more membrane you have, the more proteins you can fit in there. So it makes it much more efficient. That's why you have folding back and forth. Peroxisomes are shown next door to that. And a peroxisome, and it looks just like a lysosome, right? Well, yeah, because they're both little vesicles made out of the same stuff, membrane. But peroxisomes are similar to lysosomes. They're processing things away from the rest of the cell. Peroxisomes are, though, dealing with and breaking down products of cellular respiration that are known as reactive oxygen species, or ROS, including peroxides of various sorts. Reactive oxygen species, including peroxides, are oxidizers. They're oxidants, and they cause things to be oxidized, in other words, which can damage materials, which is why you have all kinds of companies making antioxidants or foods containing antioxidants. That helps as well. But peroxisomes do that as a specialized job. These microvilli, now speaking of surface area, these microvilli are named because the word villus, which is the singular, means finger-like projection. There's all kinds of villi over in various parts of the body. Microvilli are just small finger-like projections because each microvillus is really just a little projection of plasma membrane from the surface. And so it's also just like the folding of the inner membrane of the mitochondrion. It drastically increases the surface area. Now, this is a catch-all picture, meaning not every animal cell is going to have every one of these features. This is showing them all in one place. But a good example of a cell in your body that has microvilli is the cell, or are the cells that form the endothelium, the inner lining of your small intestine, which is where the absorption takes place after you've digested the stuff. When it's small enough to finally take into your body, that taking it into your body is absorption. That requires a bunch of proteins as transport proteins to get it through the membrane into the cells. And therefore, the more membrane you have, the more proteins you can fit in there to do the job, which is especially important in the digestive tract because you only have so much time before it passes through the other end and you would lose that nutrition otherwise. Cytoskeleton. Shown in all caps here. It's all caps because the cytoskeleton is a complex system consisting of proteins of three categories. These are all protein filaments making up the cytoskeleton. So there are microfilaments, intermediate filaments, and microtubules. We can look at those individually in a different picture, but they all have their own jobs. But the cytoskeleton as a complete structure is so named, meaning cell skeleton, cyto means cell, because it's kind of analogous to our endoskeleton, our bones, our internal framework for our body, right? So is the cytoskeleton, but it's just made out of protein filaments, not bones. Not only does it provide, keep things in place, for instance, but it also serves as a system of roadways, particularly the microtubules. The microtubules, one of these three types of protein filaments, which are shown here in yellow, are just like roads. And we have things that are called motor proteins that walk along those roads, carrying things with them from one place in the cell to another.
The centrosome here is next,
which is kind of confusing because it looks like centrosome is indicating this T-shaped structure that looks like two pieces of licorice.
That's not the centrosome. The licorice is not the centrosome.
The centrosome is this yellow halo, this yellow region that's kind of indistinct, but that's the centrosome. And a centrosome is a microtubule organizing center. That's where microtubules get created and grow out from, which is why you see a bunch of microtubules coming out from the centrosome in this picture. As we'll study in detail later, centrosomes are going to be important for cell division in eukaryotes. Mitosis and meiosis, two types of cell division that eukaryotic cells undergo, involve centrosomes. Now, this T-shaped thing is one way you can tell that you have an animal cell here and not a plant cell, for instance. Not that animals and plants are the only organisms. But this T-shaped thing, which is really two pieces, each part of the T, those are called centrioles. And I wish I could tell you more about them, but we really haven't figured out what they do. Now, you would think that they would be involved in mitosis because centrosomes are, but we can experimentally remove them and still have the cell undergo mitosis normally. So it's one of the things, one of the many things that we don't know in science. All I can tell you at this point is that animal centrosomes feature centrioles, plant centrosomes don't. The flagellum that we see here, another good example of something that not all cells would have, because this is just a catch-all picture. But what's a good example of a human flagellated cell? Sperm, right. A flagellum is used for locomotion. It pushes on the liquid medium, propelling the cell through that medium, just like a propeller does on a boat. And so, you know, that's an optional thing. Not all cells have those. Okay, let's go to 6 now. And I don't have to tell you again what all the things that plant cells and animal cells have in common, so it doesn't take as long to get through this one. A plant cell has just about everything that an animal cell does, but it has certain things that animal cells don't have. For one thing, I told you that a little bit earlier, that plant cells, I think I said it, plant cells have cell walls. So, always keep in mind that a cell wall is not instead of a plasma membrane. To be a cell, you have to have a plasma membrane. Cells that have cell walls still have a plasma membrane, and it's this yellowish color right here. But exterior to that, unlike animal cells that don't have cell walls, exterior to the plasma membrane, you have these dark brownish, very thick and sturdy cell walls that hold in the pressure. And this is a good view of what I was trying to say before. The actual strong structure is the cell wall, just like the walls of this building, and the plasma membrane is like paint on the interior surface, very thin and flimsy by comparison. Another thing that you don't have in animal cells, but you do in plant cells, are these green organelles, typically about 50 per cell, depending on where you are in the plant. But this is the third of the three examples of membrane-bounded organelles. You can kind of see, well, you definitely can see multiple membranes here. We'll look at them in detail later. Let me just say for now that the major job of chloroplasts is photosynthesis, which is a way to produce organic compounds, specifically sugars, but then those sugars can get turned into other organic compounds. The important part of photosynthesis, though, is that organic compounds get created out of inorganic compounds. And only producers are able to do this. No animal, and therefore us, can do this. No consumer of any kind can do this. Consumers have to have organic material to live, but they have to get their organic, they have to get their material already in organic form. They can't produce organic material out of inorganic material. Producers can, though, and that's why the rest of the world relies on those producers, because no consumer could ever do it. We'll study the particulars of photosynthesis in its own chapter, but that, in a plant, that happens in a specialized organelle called a chloroplast. One more thing that you find here that you didn't in the animal cell is this large organelle called the central vacuole. Now, it looks empty here, and actually that's why it's called vacuole. Vacuous means empty. But that's a misnomer. It's not empty. It's at least filled with water, but usually water and other stuff as well. And the plant can use this for various things, including kind of like a waste dump. It can put things into the central vacuole that it doesn't want to be part of the general cytosol, the liquid component of the cytoplasm, to keep it away from stuff. But it also can, you know, in certain plant cells that were, if they're pigmented, like a red onion cell that you'll look at in lab, for instance, that those red pigment molecules will be in the central vacuole, not generally dispersed throughout the cell. Since it's mostly water, though, and as you see here, since it can take up a pretty big fraction of the volume of the cell, this is one reason why plants can grow a lot faster than an animal. You know, if you think about some seedlings, just overnight they can grow an inch or whatever. And some plants, much more than that. Which, that's a lot of growth for an animal overnight, right? One of the reasons, though, is that in either case, plant or animal, multicellular organisms, they grow not by growing their cells, but by adding new cells, right? They proliferate their cells. And since plant cells contain a big fraction of the volume being water, they're easier to build because this plant doesn't have to build water, right? It doesn't have to manufacture the water. It just has to imbibe it or absorb it from the soil. On the other hand, most of the stuff in a plant, I mean, in an animal cell needs to be manufactured, which takes longer. All the other stuff, well, almost all the other stuff we've talked about. One thing we didn't, though, are these plasmodesmata. That's a plural. If you're looking at just one, it's a plasmodesma. And plasmodesmata are examples of intercellular junctions. We'll look at some others that animal cells have later. But intercellular junctions are just junctions between cells. That's what intercellular means. In the case of plasmodesmata, notice that they are little tunnel-like structures going through or penetrating through the cell wall thickness from one cell, which you can see here, to the next cell, which you can imagine taking up this space. And notice that the tunnel, which bores through the cell wall material, is lined on the walls of the tunnel with this yellow plasma membrane material. So this cell that we're looking at here has a big plasma membrane, but the plasma membrane is continuous with the tunnel itself, the plasmodesma, and then will be continuous with the plasma membrane of this next cell. What this means is that even though we call these distinct cells in a plant, they're all really, their chambers are all connected. Even in a huge tree made of quadrillions of cells, it's the little compartments are all connected to each other through these plasmodesmata. And these plasmodesmata are a means of communication, things that can get through the plasmodesma, which has to be small enough and has to be the right type of stuff to get through, can be sent from one cell to the next, and therefore there's communication. We'll see animal versions of these that are called something else a little bit later. I think now that we have mentioned everything, yes, we have. So now we can go to close-up views, starting with slide 7. This one shows you two organelles in one, the nucleus and the endoplasmic reticulum. And that makes sense because of what I've already told you. They are continuous with each other when it comes to membrane. The outer membrane of the nuclear envelope folds outward to become continuous with the membrane of the rough endoplasmic reticulum. You get a slightly better view of the ribosomes that stud the surface and make it look rough on the rough ER. You get a much better close-up view, though, of the nuclear pores in this. Each of these little pieces of magenta stuff is a protein. A bunch of proteins arranged circularly make up a nuclear pore. Now, 8 gives you a close-up, although a cartoon view, of course, of a single ribosome. And what you see here is that one ribosome is made out of two ribosomal subunits, which have the descriptive names large subunit and small subunit, because of their relative sizes, of course. This is actually a lie. A ribosome is a modular device. The ribosomal subunits are modular, meaning they're interchangeable with each other. All large ones are the same, all small ones are the same. And this small subunit isn't necessarily always going to be associated with this large subunit. It's a mix and match. But what's really a lie about this is that you wouldn't see a complete ribosome with both subunits together if there weren't already also a messenger RNA molecule here clamped between the two subunits. Because ribosomes don't come together to become the complete ribosome unless they are doing the job that they're there for, which is translation. Translation, remember, is that second step of gene expression. Gene expression has the goal, so to speak, of producing a protein. But you start by reading the gene and using the information that's in that DNA to form a second kind of nucleic acid called a messenger RNA, right? That's transcription. That's the only part of gene expression that DNA is directly involved in. And then now the code is in the form of messenger RNA, which leaves, if this is in a eukaryotic cell, it leaves the nucleus through a nuclear pore and joins up with a ribosomal subunit, a small one, and then the large one would come along and get added. So that's why it's kind of a lie, but anyway, this is how they come together to form a complete ribosome. You also on this slide see the two phrases, free ribosome and bound ribosome, which is not at all a structural distinction. There are what we call free ribosomes and bound ribosomes, but they're the same thing, just in different times and in different situations. A free ribosome is any ribosome that's not attached to a membrane. Whereas a bound ribosome, as the name bound means, is bound or tied, attached to a membrane, specifically the rough endoplasmic reticular membrane. Well, you don't have a ribosome at all, not in complete form with both subunits together, until you start making a polypeptide during translation. That always starts out on a free ribosome. But in certain cases, for certain polypeptides, after the translation starts on a free ribosome, the whole complex, the ribosome plus the mRNA, goes over to the rough ER membrane and attaches to it. And that's so that the rest of that polypeptide, as it comes off, gets longer and longer off the assembly line, will get put into the ER to be modified. Not all polypeptides need to be modified, so they all start out being built on free ribosomes. Some of them go the whole way of being produced on free ribosomes because they don't need to be modified. The ones that do need to be modified finish up while connected to the ER membrane, and that's why they're called bound ribosomes. Slide 9. No new structural information is shown here, but you get a little picture of what I was talking about happening with respect to packaging things in vesicles and membranes moving around. This transport vesicle is made out of stuff that used to be ER membrane, but it's pinched off carrying some cargo of modified proteins. They're modified because the job of the ER, the rough ER, is to modify them to begin with, and that's been done already. So that transport vesicle is heading toward the next door organelle, which we see in slide 10, and once again in teal, is the Golgi complex. The Golgi complex receives the vesicle. But notice the vesicle is still in blue because it came from rough ER, but it's going to fuse into the membrane of the Golgi complex, because membrane is membrane, and now it's going to be officially a teal-colored one. Since the Golgi complex has two jobs, receiving and shipping, it is a polar organelle because these two jobs happen at different ends of the organelle. Polar just means two ends are different from each other. It has nothing to do with charge, remember. So if you think back to what we said the two versions of geometric isomers were when we were studying organic compounds, we used the cis and trans words. Well, you have cis and trans here for the different faces, the two different faces of the Golgi complex. The cis face, which is right up against the rough ER, is the receiving end. It receives the vesicles from the rough ER, which then deliver the contents, the newly modified proteins, to the lumen of the Golgi complex. The other end, which is closer to the plasma membrane, is the trans face. That's the shipping center. And so brand new vesicles get produced by bubbling off of the Golgi complex, carrying these already modified proteins to their proper destination. There's a couple processes being displayed here, as you see in A and B, phagocytosis and autophagy. Before I describe these specifically, let me say that what you have here is movement of something into or out of the cell, in this case into, but it could be into or out of the cell, using a vesicle to move it. And that kind of transport, which is one, there's three major kinds of transport processes that can move things into or out of cells. One of those is vesicular transport. But notice that that word vesicular transport just tells you that a vesicle is involved. It doesn't tell you at all which direction it's going, into or out of the cell, right? So vesicular transport is further subdivided into two kinds based on the direction of movement of the material. Using a vesicle to move things into the cell is called endocytosis. Cyte meaning cell, osis is condition, endo means within. The same process in reverse, though, using a vesicle to move something out of the cell is exocytosis. And that's all those words mean. It just doesn't tell you anything about what is being transported, just which direction. It tells you that it's a vesicle being used, but it doesn't tell you what is being moved. So endocytosis, bringing something into the cell via vesicular transport, is then further subdivided into phagocytosis and pinocytosis. Now, the phago part, which also is in autophagy here, and it's also the same root that's in the word esophagus, the eating tube, means eat. So phagocytosis literally means condition of cell eating, whereas pino means drink, so pinocytosis is cell drinking. It's exactly the same process, meaning that a little vesicle forms to take something from the environment into the cell. But we use different words because if that thing that's taken into the cell is a solid chunk, like it is in here, this brown thing is some sort of molecule, solid molecule, then we call it phagocytosis. If a cell makes a vesicle just to take a little sip of the liquid and bring it into the cell, then we call it pinocytosis. Kind of a word game. But in this case, it's taking in this brown chunk, which is it some sort of nutrient, and that produces a food vacuole, which is really just another name for a vesicle, but a vacuole is containing the material that used to be outside of the cell. And you remember the lysosomes I talked about, which are house the digestive enzymes, the dangerous things. Well, it's made of membrane itself, so the food vacuole and the lysosome can fuse together, and that exposes now the thing that's going to be digested to the digestive enzymes, so it can be safely done away from the rest of the cell. A similar thing is happening in autophagy, but that word literally means self-eating. So it's not importing something to digest, it's digesting something that's already in the cell. In this particular example, it is a mitochondrion. Well, and a peroxisome. This is a mitochondrion has seen better days. It's not functioning as a mitochondrion anymore. But that's not a total waste, right? It's made out of valuable materials. So it's broken down, and then those safely away, just like for the other example. And then those will be recycled. You can build new stuff out of the things that the mitochondrion was built from. No new information, really. It just shows you another cartoon version of the central vacuole. But when you look at the micrograph with a real photograph of it, you can really see just how much volume a central vacuole can take up. That's what I was talking about, them being able to grow quickly. 13, also really no structural information is new here, but you do get a picture of what I was trying to describe when the Golgi complex produces new vesicles to send those proteins on their way. Sometimes those are going to be exported out of the cell. And so it sends the vesicle to the plasma membrane, which can meld with the plasma membrane because it's all membrane material. And that will unfold it, and now these purple proteins, whatever they are, spill out. That's exocytosis. Fourteen is a close-up of a mitochondrion, as you see. Much better view of the two membranes here. You also see some detail that we didn't see in the earlier picture. But I mentioned why you have the folds to increase the surface area on the inner membrane. But the folds themselves, each individual little fold, which is, it's all part of the same membrane, but multiple folds in the one membrane. But each individual fold is a crista, the plural of which is cristae. What we didn't see, though, in the previous slide was that a mitochondrion has its own ribosomes. And this brings up an important point, actually, about how mitochondria originated. And the same thing can be said for chloroplasts. It's explained by what is called the endosymbiotic theory, which has a lot of compelling evidence pointing to its being correct. We studied an example of endosymbiosis in an earlier chapter, right? When the cow was eating the grass, and it was able to digest the cellulose because one of its stomachs houses endosymbiotic bacteria that live in there. One organism living in another is what endosymbiosis is. Well, this explains the origin of mitochondria. Mitochondria started out as free-living bacteria, and specifically free-living bacteria that were capable of cellular respiration. Bacteria invented cellular respiration. It's not just eukaryotes that do this. They were, for a long time, the only organisms doing cellular respiration were bacteria. This was before eukaryotes even existed. But in early eukaryotic history, these eukaryotic cells were going around engulfing smaller cells. That's how they ate. That's how they got their nutrition, which, of course, usually kills that cell, and it gets digested and used as nutrients. Somewhere along the line, one of these cellular respiration-capable bacteria living by itself gets engulfed by a eukaryotic cell, but survives the engulfing and continues living inside the eukaryotic cell and continues undergoing cellular respiration just like it did when it was a free-living bacterium. This is how eukaryotic cells got to the point of being capable of cellular respiration. They engulfed bacteria and had the bacteria do it for them. This also explains why there are two membranes. The inner membrane is the membrane the bacterium had originally. The outer membrane is the cover you put on it when you engulf it, right? When you engulf something, just like we saw in these other pictures, you're enclosing it in a piece of membrane of your own, right? So that's the outer membrane. That's how it got to be. More evidence for this is that there are ribosomes just in the mitochondrion itself, just like there are ribosomes in a bacterium. And to make that more compelling, the ribosomes that are in your own or any eukaryotic cell's mitochondria are not the same as the ribosomes in the general cytoplasm of your cells. Those are eukaryotic ribosomes. They do exactly the same job, but the subunits are different molecularly. These ribosomes are just like bacterial ribosomes of bacteria that still live. And even more compelling evidence is that not only do mitochondria have their own ribosomes, they also have their own DNA. And the DNA is arranged in circle, just like the circular chromosomes of free-living bacteria, whereas our own DNA, which is found in our nuclei, of course, are linear chromosomes. Plus, if that weren't enough to convince you, mitochondria are able to replicate by binary fission, which is exactly how bacteria become two bacteria. They split into two to become two. And all of that, everything I said there, is also true of chloroplasts. So that was a secondary, the engulfing of a photosynthetic bacterium gave rise to the first chloroplasts. That was a separate event. So our ancestors as animals were the cells that engulfed cellular respiration capable bacteria, and that's all that was engulfed. That's why we have mitochondria, but not chloroplasts. The ancestors of plants did that first, and then later engulfed a photosynthetic bacterium that also survived and became the first chloroplast, which is why plants have mitochondria and chloroplasts, whereas we have just mitochondria. All right, let's go to 15 to look at an isolated chloroplast. Remember, this is a photosynthetic organelle. Just like cellular respiration was invented by bacteria, so was photosynthesis. But for a eukaryotic cell, if it is photosynthetic, which plants are and algae are, that photosynthesis occurs in a chloroplast. We can also see here that just like a mitochondrion and just like the nucleus, this is multiply membrane bounded. Some books will say it's three membranes, an outer membrane, an inner membrane, and a thylakoid membrane. But really, the thylakoid membrane is just an elaboration of the inner membrane. So I really consider it to be two membranes. But there are three spaces, which reminds me that I should have said this for mitochondria as well. I'll go back to that in a second. But the three spaces here, three compartments, not just within the chloroplast, There's an intermembrane space between the outer membrane and the inner membrane. There is the stroma, which is the stuff that's inside the inner membrane but outside of all these green things. And then there's the chamber inside the green things. You can see in the cutaway view, all these green things are connected to each other, so it's all one elaborate chamber. And since these green things are called thylakoids, the stuff inside that space is called the thylakoid space. So there's three compartments in a chloroplast. Let me just quickly go back to the mitochondria to say that it's also, since it's multiply membrane bounded, compartmentalized. There is an intermembrane space in a mitochondrion as well, between outer membrane and inner membrane, right here as labeled. Oh, no, it's not, but this is the intermembrane space. And then the stuff that is fully inside the inner membrane is the mitochondrial matrix. Oh, it is intermembrane space is labeled. All right, so two different chambers, but also two different fluids. The stuff that's in the intermembrane space is not chemically identical to the stuff that makes up the stroma. They're separated by a membrane. Only shows you a real photograph so that you can see that these things I called thylakoids. Actually, I didn't quite finish them. It's chloroplast, sorry. These little green things individually look like coins, more or less, right? Little circular coins. And they're stacked, so it looks like a bunch of stacks of coins. Each individual coin-like thing is a thylakoid. One stack of thylakoids is called a granum. That's a singular, the plural of which is grana, G-R-A-N-A. So there are several grana, or stacks, of thylakoids within one chloroplast. And that's not just a cartoon, someone imagining that. When you look at a micrograph in 16, you can see the stacking. That's one granum of thylakoids. Maybe I should stop there, because microtubules is part of the cytoskeleton, which is kind of a new topic. It's a good time to stop. Unless there are objections.